It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. We have a fun panel. Christina Warren is here from Microsoft. Phil Libin from that's the name of his new app. We'll tell you all about that. And our wonderful friend from This Week in Law, Denise Howell. Good thing Denise is here because we have a lot of congressional action to talk about, including the 450-page antitrust report from the Congress. We're going to talk about the iPhone 12 event. It's coming up on Tuesday. What can we expect? And John McAfee goes to jail. It's, oh boy, it's all coming up next on Twit. This Week in Tech comes to you from Twit's LastPass Studios. Now, you're focused on security, but are your employees? LastPass can ensure they are by making access and authentication seamless, whether employees are working in the office or remotely. Visit LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 792, recorded Sunday, October 11th, 2020. Get out of my grocery aisle. This episode of This Week in Tech is brought to you by Casper. From award-winning mattresses to pillows, sheets, and duvets, Casper transforms the way we sleep, one snooze at a time. Go to casper.com/twit1 and use the offer code TWIT1 for $100 off select mattresses. And by Molecule. Molecule is reimagining the future of clean air, starting with the air purifier. It's not just an innovation on existing technology. It's a scientific breakthrough in air purification. For 10% off your first air purifier order, visit molecule.com and enter the code TWIT10. And by Worldwide Technology and Cisco. When was the last time your company updated your security strategy? Are your business assets protected? WWT offers security solutions and services that will protect every endpoint of your business and help you combat the next-gen threats. Visit WWT.com/twit to get started. It's time for Twit, This Week in Tech, the show where we take a look at the week's tech news with our esteemed panel of Twits. It's a rotating panel, but everybody on the panel today has been Twitified in the past. You'll know their names. Let's start with Christina Warren, film girl. She's a senior developer advocate now, a cloud advocate at Microsoft. Not traveling these days.
Nope.
Not going anywhere.
Unfortunately. Yeah, no, I had to transfer some of my Marriott points to a friend earlier today because she is flying back from where she's been staying during this time. She's about to fly back home and she was like, I want to have a hotel room to stay in before I fly. And it was so depressing for me to like log into my Marriott account.
My points.
I was like, I miss this so much.
My beautiful points all gone. Well, it's great to have
you. My points aren't gone. It's just, you know, like there's nothing to do with them.
Well, eventually they'll expire, right? Don't they expire eventually?
I think you have to use them for some way. I'll find a way. Like before that happens, I've got too many of them. But yeah.
Points will find a way. I think the points guy had a whole article on what to do is if your airline points are expiring. Here's a guy who has a few points. Phil Libin, he is currently CEO of All Turtles at all-turtles.com, which is an incubator for AI, all sorts of cool AI stuff. He's using his latest. Hi, Phil. Good to see you.
Good to see you. I, for one, am happy to see my United points going unused this year.
Yeah, I bet. I bet you are. MMHMM.app for which is a very cool app. By the way, congratulations. I saw you just got some a big round of funding.
Thank you.
Timing couldn't be better for this. There's Phil himself. It gives you a virtual background you can use with your Zoom calls, your Skype calls. It also gives you, it's kind of got a presentation field as well, so you can have over-the-shoulder graphics and stuff. Very cool. Very cool. I'm glad you're doing well with that. And now you just have little fake clouds floating behind you, slowly drifting.
Little ducks. I'm in it for the ducks.
They're mobile. They're animated. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it moves, right? And yeah. That was Denise Howell, a longtime friend of the network. Her show This Week in Law, of course, was long running on Twit. No longer, I'm sad to say. DeniseHowell.info, her website at dhowell. I'm glad to see the kitchen is still there and doing well. And
this isn't my kitchen. This is my office.
Oh, I always thought it was your kitchen. Why did I think that?
There's no appliances.
There's no appliances. Just gas masks.
Yep.
So there's actually, it's a little slow this week, perhaps because everybody's waiting to see what Apple does on Tuesday. We are getting an Apple event. You know, it's, I suppose we shouldn't even spend any time talking about it because all will be revealed day after tomorrow. It's amazing, though, Christina, you've been an Apple fan for years. It's amazing how we pretty much nowadays before these events, we even with Apple, which was famous for its secrecy, we pretty much are not surprised by these events anymore.
No, the Apple part is the thing that I guess has been surprising me. And that's really been something that's only been, I guess, maybe the last 3 years or so where it's been consistent. Like before, we used to always get some kind of leaks in advance and some kind of predictions. But at this point, like it's now very accurate to the point that and sometimes Apple themselves have been like the source of the leaks, which is the obviously always the funniest part.
So that's interesting. You think they leak out stuff? There was always a rumor to Wall Street Journal. If the Journal had a story about an Apple event, it was probably from Apple, that kind of thing.
Right. No. What I meant was there have been instances where there have been like unprotected source code or things on their website that people found that have been references to
mistakes.
Mistakes, exactly. You know, or you know, they will have references to new hardware in certain iOS or macOS builds, that sort of thing. And I think in one case there was actually like an entire like almost like outline of a full release of some sort of product or something that again was a mistake. But what's happened recently, like the latest leak comes from someone in China, which that's interesting. And I have to wonder if that is partially impacted because of the pandemic, that maybe they don't have as many people on the ground there as usual to kind of like be protectionish.
What they've been doing, according to some of the sources like Mark Gurman at Bloomberg, is chartering flights to send Apple employees to China, but also for the most part, putting people on Zoom calls or whatever. Probably Apple uses FaceTime, but on video calls to look at parts, inspect parts. And this is a big part of the process of manufacture in China is they make prototypes. You have to approve them. It's a fairly elaborate process. And I presume by now Apple's making the phones. Although if the rumors are to be believed, and 9to5 Mac has a rundown of all the rumors, only a couple of these models will be available to order this week, particularly the iPhone 12, which is the base model, the 6.1-inch iPhone 12. Will be pre-orders will be Friday, according to the rumors, and available the following week, as is often the case with an Apple event. Mm-hmm. Also, oddly, the Pro, but not the iPhone 12 mini, which is, I think, one of the most interesting things they're selling. A 5.4-inch display, but that won't be available till November, ordered November 6th or 7th, available November 13th or 14th. That's a month off. And the big one, the most expensive one, the iPhone 12 Pro Max, it starts at $1,100. Pre-orders, according to 9to5 Mac, according to the rumors, November 13th, a month after the event, and shipping the following week, November 20th. So you're going to wait a long time if you're going to get the top of the line or even the bottom of the line. It's the middle phones that'll be available, all OLED and all with 5G. And this is one thing that's bothering me a little bit. We saw this with the Pixel 5. Anybody who's selling through Verizon, which obviously is both Google, in fact, Google, I think, has a Verizon exclusive of the Pixel 5, and Apple, has to put in millimeter wave. Phil, I have a feeling you would know better than I do, but I get the sense millimeter wave is available in a tiny proportion of the country, corners of NFL stadiums, a couple of floors on Manhattan high-rises, that kind of thing.
I think it's kind of weird how the whole 5G industry in this country has just become just all full of lies.
There's a good way to put it.
The truth is, because everyone just lies about it.
Like, yeah, like AT&T.
Like my phone right now says I'm on, you know, AT&T 5GE, where the E stands for lies.
Liar.
So I think the industry is like, intentionally, for some strange reason, completely destroyed their credibility with it, to the point where I just have a hard time caring now, because I just assume anytime I hear the word 5G, I assume someone's lying to me. Kind of like blockchain.
Yeah. The thing that bothers me is apparently these millimeter wave radios are an extra $100 on the bill of goods. So you could make the Pixel phone $100 less. You could make each of these iPhones $100 less. You're paying a premium for a feature you probably will never have access to. Or if you do, it'll be for a limited time. That's really disappointing to me. But I guess that maybe some of this is because all of these phones will be sold in China, where 5G is more available. I'm not sure. It just seems like almost a tax, the 5G tax on users.
Well, it might be, you know, they may increase the cost of the bill of materials, but having fewer SKUs may decrease the overall cost of everything. So it's not actually clear that it would be cheaper if we needed to have multiple versions, some with and some without.
Well, they do have, I mean, this is unusual for Apple to announce, if this is the case. Again, it's just a rumor, four phones at one time. They've had good success with an iPhone SE, which they would update every few years. Those have always been very popular. That's the less expensive iPhone. And then they'd have like a base model and a big model. But four phones in one, I can't remember them doing that any time in the past. So they do have
Which
SKUs.
One of them is going to be transparent?
None of them. Thank you, Robert Scoble. None of them. He still owes me dinner for that bum prediction for two or three years ago. All OLED. Apple is finally moving to all OLED, just when the world is about to move to mini LED. I don't know what even Apple's moving to mini LED for its computers. All OLED, new colors. The mini will come in red, white, and blue, as well as black and green. So will the 12. You'll get gold and silver on the Pros, as well as graphite and blue. So colors are, whenever I see colors in a phone, it tells me that the new features are not enough to distinguish it from last year's model. So they have to do something.
How dare you? Rose gold was a feature. How dare you?
Yeah, there isn't much to tout on this. I presume they'll use the A14 chip they have in the iPad Air. Anyway, we'll do our normal stream, our normal challenge to Apple to take us down. We do that every month now, it seems like. And according to Mark Gurman and Bloomberg, he buried it in a story a couple of days ago. There will be yet another Apple event in November to announce Apple Silicon, the new
for the laptops or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Three events. Apple's just going crazy.
Yeah. They've done multiple events before, but I can't remember them being this spread out. Because usually what they would do is they would like combine the iPad with the Mac event, or the iPad with the iPhone event. But I have a feeling, I mean, as with everybody, that everyone's, you know, they'd had these phones in development for years, obviously before COVID, and that had massive implications on their manufacturing, which I'm sure is part of the reason why there have been delays, but also changes. I mean, some of the features that you're really excited about are maybe not going to be as relevant as they were, you know, when they were in development 24 months ago.
Right.
Just because the nature of how we use things is different. So, right.
Well, we'll find out. We'll be here 10 a.m. Pacific time. That's 1 p.m. Eastern time. Micah Sargent and I, right after iOS today, we'll start that early. We'll sit down. We'll watch the event. Try not to get taken down by Apple. And then MacBreak Weekly immediately after that. Phil, you've led many companies. Do companies look at what Apple does with its events and its marketing with envy? You certainly seem to be that way in the Steve Jobs era, where just nobody would command attention like Steve at one of these events.
Yeah, and we worked with Apple pretty closely in the early Evernote days, and we basically synchronized our whole release roadmap around Apple events and what we thought would be important to them. And we used to play Apple Bingo in the office, where we would distribute bingo cards for what we thought they would announce. And it was a significant portion of our own planning.
It was nerd Christmas, right? I mean, there's some of that still hangs out. But without Steve, by the way, 11th anniversary of his passing last week. Without Steve around, it's not nearly as exciting as it used to be. However, You can't say that Apple is not a juggernaut. You think it's as exciting as it was?
Well, I think like WWDC this year was the best one they've ever had in terms of like just from the, from an audience perspective. I think Apple.
I agree. Love WWDC. Like, yes.
And they were the first company to kind of come out and say like, well, let's not whine about how, you know, it has to be virtual. So it's not going to be quite as good as the in-person events. It was just better.
Let's like, make it better.
To,
yeah.
I've been to most of the in-person events and Apple said for WWDC 2020, we're just going to make it better than it's ever been. And they did it.
Yeah.
So it's kind of amazing. So yeah, I think in many ways it's more significant than it was before.
From the point of view of end users, for sure, and but also for the press, having the time to carefully craft these videos seems to have benefited Apple quite a bit. And I think that a lot of us are saying, you know, you should just keep doing it this way, Apple. It's funny because Google, I don't know what's going on. We talked about this last week. Google, like, it said, we're not going to do I.O. It's too much trouble. And so they not only did they delay it, they canceled it. No, not only no in person, no video, nothing. And then this last Google event, and actually the Pixel 5 was the most, well, a kind way to put it would be relaxed. It was the most kind of laid back presentation I've ever seen. And they barely spent 2 minutes on the Pixel 5. It feels like Google's just not, has lost the thread. They're just not that interested anymore.
Well, it's hard.
Go ahead, Christina.
No, I was just going to say it's difficult. I mean, I can only speak from the perspective of I worked on Microsoft's
doing a good job on the Microsoft events. I really have enjoyed those. Yeah.
No, and I mean, and I've worked on Microsoft Build. I worked on Ignite, and you know, I definitely think that I'm just saying I can understand. Like, it's difficult. Like, if it's not something, especially if events.
Yeah, but Google's a big company. Apple can do it. Microsoft can do it. Google's going. Yeah.
Well. I would say though, even though Google's a massive company, I don't know how important events have historically been to them as like a core competency. Whereas Apple events have always been like a really known thing for them. You know, right. WWDC is a known thing. Their iPhone events are a known thing. With us, you know, shows like Build and Ignite, those are really big like shows that we have lots of other events throughout the year too. And I'm certainly not trying to say that Google doesn't do other events, but I/O. So much of it, like at least traditionally, was about kind of the live spectacle that I can understand that having to figure out how you're going to transition that could be difficult. And maybe they just decided it wasn't worth the investment. I do agree with you, though, that the Pixel event was interesting.
It's kind of
lackluster.
Like
there were some.
Yeah.
I think it's probably really hard to get excited about a new phone and selling a new phone right now because the phones are also good.
Yeah, but if you don't. How could you? I mean, then customers aren't either, right?
Right. But I mean, maybe they're just putting out too many new phones too frequently. My 10 finally died a couple of months ago, and I had to get an 11. And we knew that the 12 would be coming hard on the heels of that because I had to get an 11, right? So I knew as I was buying the thing, oh, the new one will be here in a matter of months. And sure enough,
but
here it comes.
Did you feel bad because you had to buy what will be an obsolete phone? No.
No, I still feel like I'm living in the future.
Right.
There is no way that I'm using all the features of this phone. I'm probably using 10% of the features of this phone. So
there's an easy fix for Google for this to reinsert excitement into their shows. I've suggested this before. They just ignore me. They need to start pronouncing it as Googlio. Boom. And just do the mental experiment.
It'd be more fun, Googlio. The new Googlio phone.
Going to Googlio. That's all they need to do.
It sounds like a nice Italian company. Maybe they should be making typewriters. Googlio.
No, the company can say Google, just the event. Instead of Google I.O.
It's not Google, it's Googlio. Oh, Googlio. I thought you wanted to change the name of the company. Now that I would.
No, it's fine. It's just the event.
Just Googlio.
Google I.O. is like the world's most boring event.
Google I.O.
It's so close to greatness. Yeah.
So Googlio. Close, Googlio. I love it. Well, you get, Christina, you get a little bit of a pass from the House of Representatives. For some reason, Microsoft left out of this, but we're going to talk a little bit about the congressional report that came out this week after an 18-month investigation. They've talked to everybody. They got a lot of evidence, a lot of emails, and they came out with a 450-page report condemning big tech and saying we probably ought to break up Facebook, Amazon, Google, and Apple. They didn't mention Microsoft. Did you feel left out a little bit?
Okay, it was interesting because I did actually do a search for Microsoft. If you do a search in the document, it's like mentioned 400 times.
And but
not as one of the focus things. It's interesting, though, because a lot of the things that are cited were the Justice Department case.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it's like you've been through it already, so don't have to bother you again.
Well, that was sort of the
interesting thing.
Yeah. And I'm obviously not a lawyer, but this is the thing that I think to me is kind of instructive about this, is that we've kind of gone through this before. And I think that the cynical part of me is going, regardless of whether or not it would be even feasible to split some of these companies up, like taking that aside, like let's pretend that it is, and it might not be in some circumstances the way that they would want to, but like let's pretend that it would be. Like, the cynical part of me doesn't think that it's likely in the slightest, for lots of reasons, but the biggest one being that when there was, you know, a Justice Department like investigation, and to be clear, this is not a Justice Department investigation, this is just Congress basically wanting to maybe push the Justice Department to you know, take action. What wound up happening was a settlement, and, you know, most of it was overturned. And so it obviously had a massive impact on Microsoft as a company, and I think changed the way that, you know, they've done business going on. I think had a massive change on their trajectory in terms of, you know, maybe slowing certain things down or you know, certain things happened that maybe wouldn't have happened if that trial hadn't happened and if that settlement hadn't happened. But ultimately, the company remained intact, right? And 20 years later,
it did not break them up. There were some who said
it didn't break them up.
Yeah.
And 20 years later, you know, they're mentioned, you know, repeatedly in this report, but not as the subject, as one of the companies being targeted, which is interesting, right? So the cynical part of me kind of says, like, even if you accept the idea that these are things that should be done and it's feasible for this to happen, I don't actually think that we will see, you know, these big companies split up, at least not the way that people might envision it being split up.
I want to take a little break because I do want to get deeper into this. And thank goodness we have an actual attorney present. So
yes.
you can analyze this a little bit better for us. But the House Committee on the Judiciary's Antitrust Subcommittee finally came out with this very long report, a report that was not, by the way, bipartisan as we thought it would be initially. It was the report from the Democrats. Republicans would not sign on to it because they didn't like the idea of breaking these companies up, which is a kind of traditional Republican point of view. And they didn't like the fact that it didn't mention censorship of conservative voices, which apparently was a big issue for some of them, particularly Jim Jordan and Matt Gaetz and people like that. But we will take a break and give you a chance to get your thoughts together on the, and maybe if you want, we'll give you a minute to read the 450-page report. Actually, went through it on This Week in Google almost page by page. It was gripping. We'll do that in just a second. Denise Howell's here. It's great to have you, Denise, from This Week in Law. Phil Libin, creator of one of the CEOs of Evernote, almost creator of Evernote, creator of half of Evernote. Is that fair to say that, Phil? You did half of Evernote.
I think far less than half.
Okay.
1 or 2%.
Okay.
On a good day.
Did a little bit more with allturtles.com, where he founded and CEO there. And he, of course, is now working on and using, he's dog fooding. Mm-hmm. And it looks pretty darn good. We're going to get a tour of Paperland. It's been fun. Also from Microsoft, where she is a senior cloud advocate and still always will be our film girl, Christina Warren. Great to see you. We had your cohort last week, Simone de Rochefort from Rocket, and she was really good. We had a lot of fun with Simone. But you know what? That show is a great show. Brianna Wu, Christina Warren, Simone de Rochefort, that is like three of my favorite people on one program. You do a good job. That's a really great
show.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Yeah, we just celebrated 300 episodes, which was great.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Our show today brought to you, as it often is, by our friends who put me to sleep, Casper. Now, this is a case where you really do want to get nice and quiet and sleepy and not too over-agitated. Every time you go to bed, you're going to spend hours, a third of your day in bed. You ought to have a great mattress. You've all heard of Casper. You know, I've talked about Casper. There I am with my brand new Casper king-size mattress. Look at that in the surprisingly compact box. They're the sleep company with outrageously comfortable products at far less than outrageous prices. From award-winning mattresses to pillows and sheets and duvets, Casper is transforming the way we sleep one snooze at a time. Oh, I love our Casper mattress. I use the Casper pillows. We had a Casper dog bed. They have bedding, bed frames, yes, dog beds, everything you need to build the bed of your dreams. Every Casper mattress is designed with one thing in mind, to react and adapt to your body all night long. Inside, precisely, I counted them, 1,501 perforations to create a cooling system so effective you won't even notice it. But sleeping cool is so important. Only Casper mattresses are made with 86 supportive gel pods, so they align to your spine, eliminate aches and pains. Together, it's the cooling, supportive comfort you need for the most refreshing feeling come morning. And one of the ways that Casper works is you don't have to go to a showroom. You know, those mattress showrooms double the price of your mattress, so Casper saves you a ton of money. And instead of trying a mattress in the showroom for a few minutes, you can try it for 100 nights, risk-free. Their risk-free sleep-on-it trial with free shipping and painless returns to the U.S. and Canada. But you know what? They're never going to get my Casper out of my hands. I love my Casper mattress. 20,000 reviews on Casper, Amazon, and Google. An average of 4.8 stars. Casper is easily becoming the Internet's favorite mattress. And now with 0% APR financing options, there's no reason not to try a Casper tonight. It really is fantastic. It's almost as if they were planning for this thing. They said, you know, someday people won't be able to go to a mattress store, but they'll want a really good night's sleep. We'll be there for them. Casper.com/twit1. If you'd go to that special address, that'd help us, so they know you saw it here. And we'll reward you if you use the offer code TWIT and the number one, TWIT1. You get $100 off select mattresses. That's offer code TWIT1 for $100 off select mattresses at Casper.com/TWIT1. Terms and conditions apply. See Casper.com/terms for more information. Casper.com/TWIT1. And the offer code is TWIT1. A good night's sleep. It's hard these days sometimes to sleep. You got a lot on your mind. There's a lot going on in the world. Don't let your mattress be the thing in between you and a good night's sleep. Casper.com/twit1. Denise, did you read the 450-page report now?
I cannot claim to have read the 450-page report. I think it's funny that your lead-in is the Casper ad, because are you trying to suggest that national antitrust findings are sleep-inducing?
Oh, Lord.
I would beg to differ. And I think that the point that you and Christina were making about Microsoft is not just interesting, but actually super important and a good sort of, I don't know, overview gloss on considering all this is when go back and remember that Microsoft was under antitrust scrutiny from 1990 through 2002, 12
Yikes.
Years. Yeah. So, and it just dragged on and on. And now they're not even, the mentions in the report are
past.
Referencing all yeah. that past stuff we learned about going after a tech giant in antitrust proceedings. And they're, so what it reminds me of most of all is that famous quote from Ferris Bueller that life moves pretty fast. And if you don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it. I feel like in this industry, life moves very fast, and life has moved quite fast for Microsoft, and they are no longer an antitrust threat as far as Congress is concerned. And if they looked around a little while, they might find that Google and or Facebook and or Apple and or Amazon might be less of a threat a little ways down the road too. I mean, it's a very fluid kind of business. Does anyone really feel that Facebook is going to be the be all and end all of social networking, say 12 years from now? I don't think so. But
I'm going to say something controversial. Okay. I guess. I think that the DOJ action against Microsoft was a success, and that the consent decree that Microsoft eventually did sign up for, which include, by the way, somebody on site, an ombudsman on site, monitoring their behavior to make sure that they didn't behave anti-competitively, helped Microsoft a lot. It steered them in the right direction. It opened up the paved the way for things like Google and Facebook to emerge. And Microsoft's done very well. I think that it was actually a success on both sides. It was good for Microsoft, and I think it was good for the country. Is that?
Yeah, I'm not going to dispute that at all. But I do feel like what Congress has done here is basically take on these companies for being big as opposed to being monopolies and or engaging in anti-competitive practices. And that's sort of where I feel like they lost their bipartisan support and where I feel like this could just sort of peter out. I guess the biggest part of the report, the biggest ask that it makes is for Congress to alter the antitrust laws so that they have more flexibility. And maybe the antitrust laws resemble more or relate more to what's going on in the current technology industry, which, you know, they're very ill fitted to right now. And you had that great piece in the rundown on anti-monopoly versus
Ben Thompson.
Antitrust. Yes, yeah. Ben Thompson's piece. Yeah. I encourage people to read that. That's really good.
He quotes a scholar in economic policy, William Letwin, who wrote a book on the evolution of the Sherman Antitrust Act. And actually, I want to read this quote because it kind of gets to the heart of the matter. Letwin says that hatred of monopoly is one of the oldest American political habits. And like most profound traditions, it consisted of an essentially permanent idea expressed differently at different times. Monopoly, as the word was used in America, meant at first a special legal privilege granted by the state, like your cable company has a monopoly, unfortunately. Later, it came to more often mean exclusive control that a few persons achieved by their own efforts, but it always meant some sort of unjustified power, especially one that raised obstacles to the equality of opportunity. And I think that that is a legitimate fear. If there is a failing in the free market economy, it is that it is possible in a free market economy for a company to become so powerful that its dominance allows it to enter and control other markets, which essentially destroys the competition that makes free market work. And so I think that that is one of the few controls that a government must exert on a free market, is this control of monopoly. Now, Phil, I have no idea where you stand on this, so I'm going to let you tell me I'm full of it if you want.
I think this is the man with a hammer syndrome, right? Mm-hmm. If you only have a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Right.
I think that the big tech companies are doing a lot of harm to the world. A lot of good as well, but clearly some harm. And I think they're looking into the kind of harm that they're causing and trying to figure out ways to mitigate that harm is super important. I'm just not sure that breaking them up actually achieves that in any way. I think
as Christina pointed out, we didn't break up Microsoft, but we still were able to accomplish some things.
Yeah. I think that the harm that Microsoft was doing, even allegedly, and I kind of agree with you that it was probably the consent decree was probably a good thing overall, but that was like, okay, yeah, I guess they're shutting out some competitors. The harm that, Facebook's doing has much more to do with like the harm they're causing to the rest of the world, not so much on companies that may want to compete with Facebook.
Yes.
I think
yes.
Antitrust is a very narrow lens to look at this through. And the idea that like the reflexive reaction is let's break the companies up. Like I think that's going to make a lot of things worse.
Yeah.
Like, I think Facebook broken up into 10 parts is completely not clear to me why that's not 10 times worse than Facebook right now.
Well,
it's just like the easy answer.
As Denise pointed out, I mean, the good news is, A, this is not even a nonpartisan report. The Republicans disagree about the breaking up as well. B, Congress has a few other things to think about. C, there's an election 3 weeks away, and they're going to be a lame duck Congress. It doesn't look like anything's going to be happening anytime soon.
And I really like Phil's point that we don't necessarily need a hammer and this isn't necessarily a nail. There are a lot of other laws that are available. I'm thinking of, California pops to mind has a really broad and sweeping unfair competition law. And it seems like some of the things that are complained about in the 450-page report, by the way, Wired has a really nice 14 juiciest quotes from the House antitrust report. If you're looking for a cheat sheet,
now that is clearly link bait. There is nothing juicy in this report. It's the okay, good. I'm gonna have to look that up.
Looking for sort of the meat and what, yes, you know, I mean, it's hard. From the coverage I've read of it, and as I said, I did not go through all 450 pages, but what commentators tend to come up with, having read through it, and God love them for having done that for us, is that there wasn't a lot of concrete example given of anti-competitive or monopolistic behavior. Yeah, the complaint seemed to be, we've got big companies doing bad things.
Right.
If we've got big, you know, if we've got any company doing bad things, we have a lot of laws we can use to address that.
I actually think that Phil, you nailed it, so to speak, because for instance, with the problem with Facebook is not that they're so big, it's the monopoly, not a monopoly. And Facebook defends itself saying, well, you know, there's the whole internet to compete with us. It's just that they have such power and dominance over the discourse in this country that's scary.
Yeah, let's.
Well, not just this country, but the world.
The world. Right? Yes.
Yeah, I think there's a class of problems that can be solved by restricting what companies do in general, and there's a different class of problems and a much smaller class of problems that could be solved by breaking up like a single company. And we just, I think for historical reasons, just, you know, immediately go to the, oh, they're big. And so they break them up. And it just never made any sense to me. Like if you had, you know, if you had 10 companies and they were all, they were all just dumping cyanide into the water because, you know, that's what they decided to do. But there was 10 of them. It's clearly none of them were a competitor, were a monopoly. There were just 10 and they were equally sized. And there were 10 companies dumping cyanide into the water and like killing everyone.
Right. That's a problem.
Antitrust is not the solution to that. You would just be like, hey, no company can now dump cyanide into the water. You wouldn't like take the biggest one and break them up, which wouldn't necessarily fix the problem. And this is what we have now. We have like social media makes money by keeping you upset.
Yes.
Like social media makes money when you are upset.
Yes.
And that's a problem. And it's a problem if there's a monopoly doing it. And it's a problem if there's 50 companies evenly distributed doing it. The problem is that business model is deeply detrimental to the world and, you know, shouldn't exist. I share, I think, a lot of the suspicion of big tech and the desire to improve it. But I think, the only people I trust less are probably the, you know, Congress. And B, yeah, I think antitrust is just it just doesn't seem like the right fit, the right framework for this at all.
Here's one example from that 14 juiciest quotes piece in Wired that jumped out at me. One of the things the report calls out is that certain employees at Amazon, were other Seattle company, were getting information about the third-party sellers marketplace due to their role at Amazon, the data they were able to access because there were employees there. And then they were establishing their own side hustle where they could compete more readily as a third-party seller on the marketplace because of the information that they're getting straight from their employer. Well, that's not the employer's problem, except for those people should be fired and disciplined. That's not an antitrust issue.
Well, and I should also point out, as others have, that, Walmart does the same thing. Every grocery store in the country can do the same thing. They know what's selling. And when grocery store came out with generic goods, you know, unlabeled goods, I'm sure they use data about which products sold the best to determine which generic goods to sell. That's called retail.
Right.
Normal.
But to Denise's point, you know, if employees are going to be taking information that they gather in the course of their job to establish a secondary business that competes against, you
know, the employee's fault.
Other stuff.
Yeah,
exactly. That's exactly it. It's like, okay, you know, and I'm sure that I would be shocked because I know my handbook, like we have very set out rules for how moonlighting works. Yeah. And our agreement is actually really robust and allows us to do a lot of things that you would think maybe you wouldn't. But there are very clear lines. And like that would be a clear line, which is to be like, okay, if you have access to this information, you can't create. It's kind of like, you know, SEC rules around, you know, insider trading and stuff like that. Like it's to me, that seems like, okay, that should be about either enacting laws that make people who break, you know, handbook guidelines or whatever, things like that illegal, or, you know, working to mitigate that in some other way. But it doesn't seem like it's antitrust just because someone has access to something and then chooses to act in a way that is unethical.
Right. I remember, actually, when, remember Bezos and Zuckerberg and Sundar Pichai and Tim Cook were testifying via Zoom to Congress. I remember when they asked Jeff Bezos about this very subject, and he said, well, if that's happening, that's against the rules, and I don't like it, but I don't know if it's happening. He, mm-hmm. I don't think he'd be too pleased to know that that was happening. So that's a ridiculous.
Yeah. And I think that there was, and I don't know if this was in the report. I skimmed the report. I read portions of it, but I have to admit
it
was
same.
Long.
Who could read it? It's 450 it. Pages. No apologies
exactly.
necessary.
And like I have other things that I want to read, yes. you know, other than
it's
like
not
this.
The most exciting. Yeah.
Right. But you know, there were some allegations in the Wall Street Journal that Amazon itself was taking some information based on products that people were selling to then directly create their own competitive products.
Yes.
That I think becomes a little bit trickier. And you could point to the Walmart example of like, you know, maybe white labeled goods or whatnot. I think it's a little bit different if you're talking about saying, hey, we're going to create an Amazon Basics or we're going to promote these things in the same way to go after this market segment. That maybe becomes a little bit squishier, but I still don't know if that becomes an antitrust thing. Because well, as you said, I mean, like, this is retail. This
nor is it an excuse to break Amazon up. And,
right,
and by
right.
the way, I don't know how you would break up Amazon.
Well, that's the other thing, too. How do you break up any of these companies? I mean, this is one of the interesting things that has kind of happened in response, I would argue, to the Microsoft stuff was that a lot of these companies started to form themselves. I would definitely cite Facebook in this way. And maybe I'm wrong on this, but it seems like they formed themselves and kind of have, you know, made themselves operate in a way that would be very difficult to extract.
Facebook is clearly doing that. They just did this by creating a single sign-on for Messenger,
exactly.
WhatsApp, Instagram, and Facebook.
The messaging, they've done everything they can.
Intentionally.
They say, yes. So I think that if anything, I mean, in some cases, again, it really does come back to how feasible would this action even be? Like, what does that even look like? And Amazon, you know, what's interesting to me is that they talked a lot about its dominance in e-commerce. And there was a section on cloud computing. And obviously, it's on my Chiron. And I will disclose I work at Microsoft, which is a competitor. And I work in cloud. And I'm not trying to comment on any of that, except to say that although there was an entire section on cloud computing wasn't the focus area of, you know, where they were kind of looking at wanting to break things up by dominance. Most of their like kind of focus on the monopoly aspect was still around retail. And to me, that was sort of interesting because if you look at, I guess, the future of tech and where things are being invested, maybe that seems like off. I don't know. But right. but again, it just kind of indicates like how would you separate these companies? Like, how would you separate Google?
Well,
I mean, I think that
I could think there's a for instance, you could easily say, well, we should never have let Facebook buy Instagram. We should never have let Facebook buy WhatsApp. Clearly,
well, WhatsApp, I think you could say. Instagram, I don't think you could say that. I think that Instagram, that was $1 billion. A lot of people criticized them at that time. I was all I thought it was brilliant when they did it.
But it was anti-competitive, right? I mean, their fear was the young people are moving to Instagram.
It was anti-competitive, but I mean, I think that Instagram, what
they tried to buy Snapchat before they got Instagram because they were even more threatened by Snapchat.
No, Snapchat didn't even exist then. They bought Instagram.
Oh, it was later. Okay.
Yeah.
But they did try
yeah,
to buy Snapchat.
Was it anti-competitive or was it prescient and a lifeline to the future?
It was
because,
prescient.
As I mentioned
yes.
before, I just don't see Facebook as a platform. You know,
I
kind of see it going the way of Friendster and other things that we've been
I agree with you.
Long
Instagram
farewell
has,
to in the rear view.
I 100% agree. I think WhatsApp, you could make the argument, right? WhatsApp was $47.5 billion or something by the time everything was said and done. WhatsApp was clearly, you know, a threat to Messenger and was already an established enough business and Facebook was already established enough at the time. I think you could make an argument that maybe that should have had more scrutiny. Instagram, I agree with Denise. I think that was prescient. That was them saying, this is going to represent the next wave of social interaction. Our own attempts at doing photos doesn't work. So we are going to buy this company that has 13 employees and, you know, spend $1 billion on it and turn that into our future, which is what they've done.
That's an interesting thing. Would Instagram have been as big a threat if they hadn't? I mean, this is clear. This at least is a clear part of antitrust law, right, Denise, is this idea of you're not allowed to acquire competitors to reduce competition and consumer choice. That's actually against the law.
Well, I mean, it depends on what your market position is.
You have to be big to do that, obviously.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah. And so I think it gets kind of squishy in that regard.
Because Instagram just wasn't that good yet.
Right.
You weren't even on Android yet.
Right.
And I was kind of there.
We come back around to this notion of unfair competition and the notion that they want to sort of revamp the antitrust laws. And maybe it's that Congress should do, or maybe there should be sort of a national standard for unfair competition and more concrete definition as to what that is and what sort of practices, you know, I mean, you could call them anti-competitive or not, but maybe they're just unethical, you know, when you're using the data that you have.
Is it legal to be unethical? I wonder. Phil, you've been trying to get a word in edgewise. Yeah. You were there during this?
I mean, when Instagram was bought by Facebook, and I can remember that day, I was, you know, talking to a lot of the principals as it was happening about other stuff. I think what Instagram had, like, what, 13 employees or 18 employees?
Yeah, it was very small. Yeah.
I think to say that you make a startup, you grow to 13 people, you have your pre-revenue, and you can't get acquired because of antitrust, like that's right. Borderline
but,
ludicrous.
But now that they are that powerful, does not that reduce? I'll give you another example. I think it's not unacceptable to say to Google, you need to divest YouTube, because I think it tarnishes the search results that Google owns one of the biggest content creators on those search results.
I think you got to say, what are the problems that are that we like? What problems are these things causing? And
that's a problem. Nobody can compete with YouTube because, I mean, how are you going to compete if Google owns YouTube? You can't compete because Google's just going to prefer YouTube results, and you're gone.
But the answer to that wouldn't necessarily be to break them up, right? They could be broken up and then still just enter into an exclusive contract.
Well, that's collusion, and that also is illegal.
Well, exactly. So there's like that activity could be regulated, right? You can say that a search engine shouldn't be able to favor not necessarily their own, but any particular party.
Honestly, this is my pet peeve is that Google has so much power because if you're not on Google, you don't exist. They effectively are the gatekeeper to the whole internet. And I think that as a result, Google search should be treated as a very special category. And in a way, I think, I don't know what the answer, I don't know if there's any governmental solution to this, but Google search should almost, that should be a priesthood.
Yeah, I think that should be splitting up Google.
Yeah.
I think there's like real problems and there's hypothetical problems. Sorry.
Right, and I don't know I completely buy the premise that you only get YouTube results on Google because they're favoring them. You know, I get Vimeo results and C-SPAN.
Yeah, but go ahead and search because you mostly get YouTube. And Google's answer is, that's the best answer to that query. And it's hard to deny that.
Exactly. So I think this is, like, there's a very large number of things that I could hypothetically be upset about. That are like hypothetical problems in the future. Oh, well, maybe if they do this and they'll be really bad if they do that. And then there's like a smaller number of things that are actually terrible and actually happening. And we don't have to guess about. And I think there's like enough actually terrible things I'm just much more animated by like the actual harm that's happening instead of the hypothetical harm.
Yeah, but you understand, I maybe do have a dog in this hunt because as a content creator, you know, I'm not going to, we're on YouTube for one reason. So you can find us, right?
Right.
Well, we are on, you know, we make stuff and we are on everything. And it's not clear to me that it would be easier if there was no YouTube. You know, we also put stuff up on Instagram and Twitter and everything else. And there's a whole team that tries to figure out what to do for which. I don't know that the world has ever been less friendly. I mean, sorry, more friendly to creators in terms of
getting to people. But you said that at the very beginning, and that's part of the, you know, that's the argument is, well, right. Look how much we get from tech.
Yeah, like it's working for that part of it. So right. I can see the hypothetical abuses, and I'm sure some of those abuses have been real, but I'm just less upset about that than the actual stuff that's happening.
Right.
That's like another example I would throw in is Microsoft's acquisition Twitch. Which was a very robust
Amazon.
Video.
platform. Bought
Amazon.
Twitch.
I'm sorry, Amazon.
Microsoft bought Mixer. Yeah, and you saw how that worked.
Seattle. We bought Beam. That's not how the same result.
Yes, same goal.
Same goal. Different result.
Yeah. But buying a company and then not doing much.
If there were a tech news network that was all videos of tech news that was like Twitch, you might be there instead of YouTube.
Right. Christina, you've been trying to say something.
Yeah, no, all I was going to say is that I do feel like Google is, I mean, and I agree with Phil, like I think that there is something that's interesting to separate, which is, okay, when you look at some of the actual atrocities that big tech can create, like I think of the situation in Myanmar and the role that Facebook played with genocide, which is a massive problem, and that to Phil and Denise's point, like antitrust action's not going to solve that, right? Like that's actually like a much bigger and much more difficult problem to look at. But I do actually think that Google is interesting in that you can find like Yelp, you can find actual business cases, any of the travel companies where there has been like disproportionate impact on businesses when Google gets into those areas and the way they prioritize their own results and their own features over any of those competitors, regardless of like what might have the most accuracy or not. Like I do feel like in that context and some of the anti-competitive stuff, Google probably has some good examples there. I don't know about, you know, I don't think I agree with splitting of YouTube. I think that that is a bigger conversation. I mean, it's interesting. The number two search engine in the world is YouTube. And I think that there's for a certain class of users, you know, YouTube is their front end, or Twitch, you know, or anything like that. Like even Facebook, like that's their front end to the internet as much as Google is. But I do feel like there are interesting things to look at, such as with, you know, things like flight data, where Google actually owns the company
that
provides almost all the flight data that every other company has to license. And Google owns this and has their own competitive product. The fact that the Google, you know, the way that they're listing for different, you know, restaurants and other businesses will take precedence over those own restaurant or businesses websites, or will, you know, take precedence over things from, you know, places like Yelp. And their shopping portal stuff where they, you know, prioritize their links and the companies that they have affiliations with over the number one online retailer, Amazon, right? Like there are some interesting things I think you could say there that you could look at and look at trying to regulate in some ways. Like I think that it would make sense maybe more than breaking things up to say, okay, there needs to be a Chinese wall that is part of the search product, where the search product is not able to,
that would be okay.
Like
I'd be
prioritize the Google products over other things, which for many, many years was the case. And then that stopped being the case.
Yes.
And
they merged. They did the same thing Facebook's doing right now. They merged the accounts, right? So it's all one account, one Google account. And all the information gathering happens from all the platforms.
Exactly. But, you know, but in the old days, like Google used to limit on their search pages, like how many, how much the portion of the things would be their own stuff. And at this point, if you Google something, sometimes the first page will just be, you know, various Google blocks. And it's all done for like the user's interest, but it's also done for Google's interest. And I mean, maybe the solution is there should be some sort of, again, like Chinese wall limiting some of that intervention, but I don't know if having that solution requires splitting the company up. And also to Phil's point, I don't know if splitting these companies up will necessarily, like, I don't think that splitting up Facebook is going to end the atrocities that are happening because of, you know, disinformation being spread and propaganda, you know, campaigns being spread by foreign governments.
What if Google tried to buy TikTok? Should that be allowed? I know Microsoft wanted to. I don't think anybody was worried about that. But should Google be allowed to buy TikTok? Wouldn't that be an anti-competitive problem?
I wouldn't have a problem with it. But again, just I wouldn't. No, I mean, I think like
if it were Facebook, I think yes. But if for Google, I don't know. I mean, I don't see Google as a primarily social company.
Honestly, I think all of these things have a short shelf life and are really just based on innovation. And,
it's always, you know, Google. It's always been the case, Phil, that that nobody was an incumbent forever, that, you know, MySpace owned the market until Facebook came along, that there's always been turnover. Is it, do you still believe that that's the law of technology? Or do you think that at some point, because of the network effect, an incumbent can become so big that it can't be unseated?
Well, okay. What is the difference between being acquired by Google and going public as a publicly listed company? Like, which one of those is better for the world, which one of them is less of a scam? Right? They both have aspects of both of those things.
Well, what's the negative going public?
Well, I mean, IPO processes are you know, quite scammy, right? You know, available.
Okay, but in principle, the notion that you have the public is investing and becomes part owner of your company, that's in principle good, because now you have to be much more open about your financials. You have to
absolutely,
yeah.
But in principle, the idea that you can start something and build it up and sell it to a larger company is also a good idea.
Maybe. I think, like, if that larger company becomes like the big fish that keeps eating all the little fishes, pretty soon you only have one fish.
But if they engage in behavior that actually hurts any aspect of the community, right, that actually hurts the larger world, which is the thing that ought to be looked at. Like, for me, I kind of have three buckets for this. I think there's companies who are actively designed to be harmful. Like, I don't know, I hope none of these are advertisers with you. Like, let's say DealDash, right? Like, you see that on TV, right? Yeah. DealDash obviously needs to be illegal. People behind it should be in jail.
Are those the guys who sell, you say, you can get an iPad for
$4. Exactly. And it's just like, it's just straight up lying, right? Like, everything about it is just straight up lying. It would be illegal in most countries. They're just like, it's purely exploitative.
Apparently it's legal in the United States. Nobody's stopping them.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It would be illegal in most other countries.
Oh, illegal in most other countries. Yeah, not here. Yeah.
And there's a bunch of companies like that. And like those are just terrible places, terrible companies. They specifically and intentionally exist to harm people.
I think you can make the case. And again, I hope this is nobody's personal pet, but Robinhood, the investment market, is really designed to fleece young people.
Yeah.
Well, so there's companies like that. And, you know, there's a spectrum. Between, you know, how like DealDash, like there's literally zero redeeming things. It's just got all that whole ill.
I'm glad to hear you say that, because I see those ads and I wonder. Just look into it for
5 minutes. It's just horrible. So that's like category A, right? Bucket one, category one is like, these are just companies that are just actively just trying to.
But wait a minute. They say they're the fair and honest bidding site.
I know. It's amazing. right. Category B are companies that they didn't set out to be horrible. They're just drawn that way. Like, their business model just makes everything like kind of a structural conflict, right? And a lot of the big social media companies fall into that bucket now, where they make
money.
They're
not evil.
They're not trying to be.
In fact, they're trying to be good, I would guess. Yeah.
They are. And like, Twitter is actually doing, I think, heroic work to really like seriously try.
Yeah. And on Google's goal of putting all the world's information at your fingertips, that is a laudable goal. That is a world-changing goal, and to some degree they've done it
well. And there's aspects, like, take Google for example. The Google search product is pretty well aligned. Like, Google search ads make money if you click on them, but you're likely to click on them because you're searching for the thing that the ads came out for, so there's a high amount of intentionality. So like, there's actually not that many problems with Google search, and it's where most of their revenue comes from. The problems come in with their indirect business model companies like YouTube. Like, YouTube's business model is they want you like riled up, so you keep clicking on links. And so they're just going to recommend things that rile up, and you get the echo chamber, and you get all of the social media stuff. So even like something like Google, like, it makes most of its money in search ads in a thing that isn't actually that terrible. It's pretty good.
Now,
there's hypothetical problems with it, but for the most part, it's okay. But then there's stuff like Facebook and YouTube and other things which are just like actively doing a lot of harm, not because they're bad people, unlike DealDash, we're just bad people. just because, you know, their business model makes it very hard not to do harm. And so that's like bucket two. And then there's bucket three, which is like the Google search stuff and Apple, where there's things that we can say are hypothetically going to be problematic if they act certain ways. And we should, you know, put in the safeguards so they don't act in those ways. But it's not really a big problem right now. And I'd much rather see like regulators focusing on bucket one and bucket two. Probably antitrust is not the answer to any of them. The answer to bucket one is that those practices should be illegal. The answer to bucket two is there ought to be like significant reform in the companies. And, you know, maybe sometimes it's okay to break them up, but I'm not sure what that would achieve in these cases.
Let me ask the attorney. Does antitrust law allow for the notion that something's potentially bad, or does a bad act have to be committed? Is it enough to say that you have too much power?
Again, I'm not an antitrust lawyer, but my understanding is no, that you had your power alone is not going
to
be
something bad has to happen before you can get in trouble.
Like, and we've been talking about different shades of, you know, questionable acts versus you know, when you see it, it's a bad act. The thing that came up over and over again for Microsoft over its 12 years was its tying of the browser to the operating system. And people just looked at that and said, no, you know, you can't do that. You're the dominant operating system. This is the computer everybody uses. If you're making it hard to get to another browser, that's just anti-competitive. And so, yes, it wasn't just being the dominant player that was the problem. It was the deciding they were going to leverage
malfeasance.
That.
You need to do something evil.
Exactly. And so, I mean, the thing that we just keep coming back around to is, you know, how do we limit bad corporate behavior? And there are certainly laws out there, you know, that ban bad corporate behavior. They can't commit fraud. They can't do false advertising. There's a whole myriad of things that will get a company in trouble. But it's, you know, the little individual case of a decision that looks shady that tends to sort of fall under this laissez-faire free market blanket that we adopt. And that's why, you know, you throw enough of those at the wall and eventually someone says antitrust. And maybe what we need is more of a corporate governance. You know, I mean, we took such a handoff approach to the internet at the beginning so that these companies could rise to the levels that they've now achieved. And maybe now it's time to just say, okay, you know, now we need some guidelines. We need some a rule book for you guys to play by.
Okay.
I should say, of course, that I don't actually know the Deal Dash people, and they may be wonderful human beings.
Yes. And Robin Hood is doing the God's work to make it possible.
Robin Hood, actually know a bunch of them and actually like them a lot. And I think Robin Hood is like I don't think they were evil by design at all. I think it's interesting to think through what the actions are, what consequences there were.
Right.
Deal Dash, I don't know at all. But in my observation, it feels like it's just a really exploitative product. Robin Hood, like, you know, this is like SoFi is like a good example of that, right? I actually know some of the SoFi people. They're good human beings. SoFi, right? Really good mission, right? You know, they want to like make student debt much cheaper for people. And they had this observation where, you know, if you're a computer science graduate from Stanford and you come out with a lot of student debt, like they could pay it off for you at a much cheaper rate because you're such a good credit risk because your future lifetime earnings are going to be great. And, you know, it's a really good product for people who fall into that category. The unintended consequence is by removing those people from the pool of student debt, are right. you making student debt more expensive for everyone right. else? Not for your customers. They're not doing anything wrong for their customers, right. but for the people who aren't their customers, are they making it worse? And they might be. Like I'm not sure, but they might be. This is like saying, you know, Uber. Like Uber has a responsibility to its drivers and to its riders. Of course they do. But they also have a responsibility for people who ride the bus. And, you know, if Uber's actions make life worse for people who can't afford Ubers in the first place, that's also a type of thing that they need to be responsible for. So I think this is like, there's a lot of things here, but there are so many things that are clearer to me that we ought to be focused on than what, you know, than antitrust and Facebook and Google, which I think is...
Give me one thing we should be focused on. Focus on it.
Well, I think the damage being done by the indirect business models, the ad-supported, micro-targeted business models of social media, and really a lot of media right now, I think, are very harmful to the world.
Yeah, the problem
I think, like,
is...
The way you do advertising is like the only way
that I agree.
Actually isn't bad for the world.
That's why we do it that way. Yeah. But the problem is... It's really hard to pass legislation on the first one. So, and it's hard to know what to do about it. And I think this is really the problem is that Congress, I don't think Congress, this is a good parallel. I don't think they're acting evilly. I think they're trying to figure out how do we solve this problem. But I think, as you pointed out, they have a hammer and maybe it takes a scalpel. Maybe it takes more subtlety. Maybe there are other solutions. This is a very difficult thing to solve. In general, are you against the notion of government getting involved in this, Phil?
No, not at all. I'm very much not a, you know, libertarian, laissez-faire, you know, guy. I like competent government.
Yeah,
I think
so
the
I.
problem is
we don't have
our
it.
Government lately has not been super competent.
we don't have it.
I very much would like it to be. In yes. which case, I'm happy to consider all sorts of smart regulations as long as there's like a way to measure it, like. Have a hypothesis about what this regulation is going to achieve, measure whether or not it's working or not, reverse it if it's not working. But we just don't do that. There's other countries that do. We don't do that very well in the U.S.
I'd agree with you. Any final thoughts before we move on? Denise, anything to add to this? I think this is a good, really actually a very good discussion. It's a thorny problem.
It is a thorny problem. And I think my stay tuned is to see if Congress picks up the thread that they dropped down that, you know, maybe we'll revisit antitrust laws and see if we can refit them. So watch for that. Otherwise, I don't see much happening here in the near term.
I did. That was toward the end of the report. And I did read that carefully because they had some very clear, I thought, well-written recommendations for ways to perhaps amend our laws to make them more effective in this light. And maybe that would be the solution, is to say, look, here's what we want to do. And now you guys, we're going to be watching to make sure you do it.
Mm-hmm. I think the most positive thing for me out of that report was there was a section where they basically said that they think antitrust laws ought to encompass harm to not just consumers, but also employees, investors, the rest of the world. And I think that's key. I think this to me is similar to something that happened, I think, last year, right, where a bunch of companies came out saying that they're not just looking for investors as shareholders. They have a broader set of responsibilities. I think this like expansion of the circle of human beings to whom we have responsibility to not only include shareholders if you're a company and to not only include consumers if you're a government regulator, but to always include everybody else is like that's a very positive development. And so I am encouraged by that. Our responsibility is always to everyone.
Yes.
Not just to the people who, you know, are either our customers or our investors.
You know, and I have to point out that, Phil, I think you reflect the sentiment of Silicon Valley in general, that the people in Silicon Valley are very smart. The tech industry are very smart. And I think as individuals, they all believe that. They believe in trying to help forward the greater good. Some people are just in it for the money, but I think most of the really successful people are thinking that way, right? Is that your experience?
I don't know if most of us are very smart. Wouldn't go that far.
You're a pretty bunch, though. You can't deny that. Any final?
Yeah, I've been getting by in looks.
Any final thoughts, Christina?
No, I mean, I think as Denise pointed out, I mean, I think it'll be interesting to see if there is any change to some of the legislation and some of the rules around this stuff. But as it stands, I mean, I think it's an interesting experiment. It's a good document. I still stand by what I said at the beginning, which is that I'm cynical and I don't actually see this, at least in the short term, having any impacts. But I do think that potentially a good impact would be if this were to make big tech companies more considerate about the way that they do things.
Yes.
Which is, you know, part of what happened with the Microsoft legislation, or not legislation, but, you know, lawsuits 2 decades ago, then that could be a net positive for everyone. If even this experiment, even if it's just a paper tiger, makes big tech companies more considerate about what they're doing in the world as a whole, whether it relates to these specific areas or the broader and like more important concerns that Phil mentions, then that could be a good thing.
I completely agree with you. And I think that might even have been the intent. I mean, I was very impressed. They spent 18 months. They gathered a huge amount of information. They had testimony from all the players. And I thought that was a very thoughtful report. And I wouldn't be surprised, Christine, if that really wasn't the intent. If they didn't know, look, there's no way we're going to break these companies up. That's just not going to happen. Not with our current legislative agenda, but we should at least make these points and maybe they will. And it's clear that Tim Cook and Sundar Pichai and Mark Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos kind of did hear what they said and are kind of paying attention. If that's the upshot of this, that's a good thing. They're paying attention. Let's take a break. Go ahead.
Oh, just before we lose this thread altogether, we touched on this whole notion that the Republicans wanted this to be much more about whether conservative viewpoints were being discriminated against. And we haven't really discussed, you know, the role that plays in any sort of antitrust analysis.
Yeah. Obviously zero, right?
Yeah.
Actually, we could spend a lot of time, maybe we will later in the show, on Section 230 because it continues to be under assault. And that is a very important basis for everything that happens on the internet, including everything we do here. And boy, it always makes me nervous when even Joe Biden said, yeah, I think we should really reconsider Section 230 President Trump is currently saying we should eliminate 230 under the guise of this. It's exactly the opposite of what he thinks, apparently, because it would, in fact, make it very easy to censor conservative thought. But okay, we're not going to talk about that. We will a little later, but later on. I want to mention our sponsor. In fact, we're breathing clean air in here. Thank goodness. Thanks to our molecule. We're all spending a lot more time indoors. And if you're unlucky enough to be in an area where the forest fires, the wildfires have been raging, you know that the indoor air, as bad as it is better than the outdoor air. Actually, indoor air, according to the EPA, can be 5 times worse than good outdoor air. And so it's really important that you do what you can to make sure the air you're breathing inside is clean. That's why we use Molecule. It's not just an innovation on existing technology. It's not really a filter. It has filtration, but it's actually more than that. It's a scientific breakthrough in air purification. They use a very interesting technology called PECO, photoelectrochemical oxidation. It traps harmful pollutants, even particles too small to be trapped by filters, and then destroys them, particles like virus, bacteria, mold, and chemicals. It's not collecting them. It literally destroys them with light. Molecule air purifiers are designed to protect homes, businesses, even medical spaces. They're destroying pollutants and providing clean air. There are a variety of molecules you can choose from at the Molecule website. Some are designed for large rooms. That's the one we've got in here, up to 600 square feet. There's a newer, smaller one, the Molecule Air Mini. That's for a bedroom or a smaller room, 250 square feet. There's the Mini Plus, which has a particle sensor and auto protect mode that adjusts the fan speed based on the sensor. And if you're in a medical office, you ought to know about the Molecule Air Pro RX. This is FDA cleared as a 510K class 2 medical device for medical purposes to destroy bacteria and viruses in the air. Many of us live inside these days when the air is bad outside. So clean indoor air is more important than ever. That's why we have a Molecule in the studio. We got another one for the house. Molecule's PECO technology meets the performance requirements in the FDA guidance for use in helping reduce the risk of exposure to SARS-CoV-2, the COVID-19 virus. Now, we didn't buy the Molecule for that, but boy, it's kind of nice to know it works in healthcare settings. And by the way, as you see on the website, there's a big research tab. Read the research from DOE labs like the Lawrence Berkeley labs. Molecule air purifier and independent testing was shown to reduce concentrations of a proxy virus they used to stand in for COVID-2. COVID-19 wouldn't be safe to test it on COVID, obviously. So they use this MS2. The lab showed that concentrations of MS2 were reduced by almost 100%, 99.9% in an hour. So, of course, you're still going to do all the other things like wear masks and wash your hands and social distance, but it is a very nice feeling to know there's an extra layer of virus protection in your spaces. Molecules, technology, and filtration systems have been tested and verified by independent third-party labs for the whole home and beyond. Molecule now offers its breakthrough PECO technology across a range of products, providing a clean air solution for a range of environments. Pick the unit that's right for your space, or you can put together a bundle and get a discount to protect your entire home, office, medical, or dental practice, or business against pollutants. I want the people who come to work here are pretty important to me, so we want to make sure they're breathing clean air, safe air. That's why we use the Molecule here in the studio. For 10% off your first air purifier order, go to Molecule, MOLECULE.com. The offer code is TWIT10 at checkout. Molecule.com. Get 10% off your first order with the offer code TWIT10, Molecule.com. Thank you, Molecule. I'm breathing easier thanks to you. It was really a big deal. We got so smoky outside, it started to smell smoky inside. Thank goodness we were able to clear the air out in here and I can breathe. That was just one more thing 2020 brought us. Wildfires. Thank you. Thank you so very much.
Yeah, I've got a couple of Molecule filters going here.
Do you? Good. Are you at work or at home?
I'm at home. Had one at home, and then we had three at the office, and then I bought one of the ones from the office when we shut down our office. So good. Now I have two here.
Yeah.
They're great.
Yeah, I mean, we can't open windows here. And, you know, I actually talked to the HVAC contractors because I want to make sure that we were getting fresh air mixed in, because you don't want to recirculate bad air. But then now I'm saying, oh, but maybe we shouldn't have so much fresh air. It's just a mess. You just can't win one way or the other. Thank goodness for the molecules. I don't know. And this is, I'm glad we have our my counselor here, our attorney, Denise, because I don't know exactly how to read. Did you read the oral arguments in Oracle versus Google on Wednesday?
Well, I listened to a lot of the audio, which is very cool that we have access to that.
Is it already up? C-SPAN. Is it on Oye or is it on C-SPAN? Where was it?
C-SPAN, yeah.
Oh.
As of the coronavirus, the court is now releasing audio more expeditious way. Yes. Yes, plus there are transcripts out there of it.
So I did not listen to the audio, but I read a little bit of the transcripts. The issue at issue, it's a fairly important issue for the tech industry, whether Oracle can copyright its Java APIs or whether Google could use them as a fair use defense. That's Google's defense. And they, of course, use them in the creation of Android, rewriting the code in a clean room environment, just duplicating the API. That is really important. That's to how the internet works. But the consensus seemed to be, and I've had experience in the past listening to oral arguments or reading transcripts, where it's you can't necessarily say which way the court's going to go based on what the justices ask. But Ars Technica, for instance, among others, Timothy Lee writing, Google's Supreme Court face-off with Oracle was a disaster for Google. Do you agree, Denise, from what you read?
I tend to be in the camp that you mentioned a moment ago, and that's that it's really hard to read the court based on the questions that are asked. I mean, you can kind of get a feel for where the justices are going, but sometimes they're very strategic about the questions that they're asking, and they're, you know, they've made up their mind, but they're trying to flesh out points for members of the court that they know are undecided. So there's a lot of stuff that goes on in that courtroom that's sort of under the surface. And it's hard to just say, oh, Justice Alito didn't seem to like that at all. You know, I mean, right. He might have another agenda going on. So it's really tough to say. And
we won't know for months what the court decides.
Yeah, it could be a few months.
Probably and the spring.
But yeah, I mean, this is another thing. I talked about Microsoft being in litigation under investigation for 12 years. This case has gone on for 10.
Yeah.
And it's when you wind it back down to the trial court level, Google actually won. Mm-hmm. And that's where the court could go with this. There are two big issues. It's whether APIs are copyrightable. Google says no. Oracle says yes. And that's really the crux of that part of the case. But assuming they are copyrightable, Google won on fair use, which is a factual jury issue that got undone at the appellate court level, which is really, really unusual. So the court could just kick it back down to the trial court, make them start all over from square one, even though they had trial 10 years ago, and say, okay, you're going to have to retry this fair use issue because that's where we're going with this.
It's worth reading the Wikipedia article on this because it is such a tangled, long, and back and forth thing. It's been to the Supreme Court before. And they kicked it back down to the lower court over this fair use thing. Mm-hmm. It is kind of an amazing story. Let me ask Phil, though, because you have good standing to talk about, how important is it that APIs can be copied in software? What would an adverse decision for Google mean to the software industry? Would it really be bad news? You're muted, I think, Phil.
I think the way this works is the most influential book that I've ever read is The Clock of the Long Now. It's by Stuart Brand.
Yes.
And he's got one chapter 7. In fact, like there's like one page in chapter 7, like one diagram that is like the most important thing I've ever read about anything. It's called The Order of Civilization. It basically shows these like seven concentric circles of how, you know, the world spins. And its main point is that, like, government and commerce are supposed to spin at different speeds. And it's supposed to feel frustrating. Like, business people are supposed to feel that government is way too slow and, like, not useful. And if they don't feel that, then you're living in a much worse society. And I think, like, this case really shows that. And I think part of what that means is court cases are almost never resolved in time. Important ones are almost never resolved in time where the decision is actually relevant to any of the companies that are part of the, you know, of the suit. They're kind of at best like a internalized deep learning that we apply in the future, kind of going forward. And so I think like the discussion around this, the fact that it's taken so long, just like with the Microsoft case, like that's the important part. And I don't know that if that decision had gone one way or the other, it would have actually had that big of a difference to either Google or Oracle right now. But the fact that the whole thing happened and took, you know, 10 years or however long it's been, and caused the discussion about what is desirable for APIs, like that's shaped the world in an important way. So to me, this is like Stewart's brand's, you know, seven-layer diagram in action, where it was kind of anticlimactic. Like, it almost didn't matter which way the decision happened to go. Like, the actual lessons were already learned and internalized from it. And those lessons are that APIs are super critical for the functioning of the world, and there need to be more of them and not fewer of them, and they need to be as, you know, as open as possible.
I think back to when IBM created the first PC. In order to create a PC compatible, I think it was Compaq. They sent some engineers into a sealed room, and they said, "You may not look at the BIOS code that IBM's shipping, but here are the things, here are the calls, and here are the responses. Here's what a compatible BIOS would need to do," and they were able to reverse engineer the IBM BIOS and start making compatible computers. And because of that, the PC revolution happened.
Yeah. Right.
So,
although it's important to note, plot point in Halton Catch Fire.
Yes,
it sure was.
That's right.
It sure was. Although it's important to note, there are two things. One, and obviously I'm not the lawyer, so I'll defer to Denise here. But one, I believe that if there was anything that would have happened from like the IBM side, that would have been a patent thing and not a copyright thing. The second thing is that was reverse engineering, whereas in this case, this wasn't a reverse engineering. This was just strictly reusing the Java, SDK,
right,
verbatim, you know, when creating Android. So it wasn't a reverse engineering situation at all. It was, in fact, there'd been discussions. And I think that this is where, you know, some of the questions kind of went into, and certainly what parts of the litigation were about and the multiple trials that have happened over this, that there'd been discussions between Sun and Google over how they would partner or not partner over the use of this, and Google didn't want to be an official signee to, you know, having licensed access to, you know, Java's, you know, for mobile, whatever it was called, I can't remember now. They wanted to create their own implementation, but they used the same API so that applications that were already written could run either without any modifications or with very limited modifications, in addition to being able to go to existing developers and say, hey, you can, you know, use a language that you already know to develop applications for our platform.
And if you are going to try and read the tea leaves from the argument, it does seem like, if you're going to take the questions at face value, that a lot of the justices had a hard time making the distinction between declaring code, which is a real fascinating way of putting things, and a method and process that would not be subject to copyright. And so trying to decide what an API is depends on what you decide, whether you decide it falls into one of those buckets. And
right.
One of the things that Timothy B. Lee points out in his Ars Technica article quite correctly is Google hired one of the most famous, most renowned Supreme Court advocates who has ever lived, Tom Goldstein. But he maybe wasn't the right guy for this job because they needed to get that explanation and they needed to get it clearly. And it doesn't seem like they were really getting it.
Justice Kavanaugh asked an interesting question. So this is over that idea that you're not copying the code, you're copying the API. He said, well, but you're not allowed to copy a song just because it's the only way to copy a song. Why is that principle not at play here? Does that show a lack of understanding?
I think so. I think so, because I thought that's because the really way you should look at it is that, okay, if you were to copy a song verbatim, that is one thing. If you were to copy a program verbatim, that's one thing. But the API is really the notes, right? So, you know, I personally do think that it was a misunderstanding. Although by the same token, I don't think that it's in any way reasonable for us to expect the jurists to have a full understanding of all these things. I think that's what the lawyer should do. But I did want
to remember Judge Alsup famously learned how to write a sort routine in Java.
That's exactly what I was going to point out. Yeah. I actually think that's what's really interesting about this is that when you look at the lower court decision and when you look at the initial decision, which Judge Alsup did, he actually took on upon himself, like he learned Java and he'd spent a significant amount of time really going above and beyond to get these things right. Those obviously were not things that then the appeals court took into consideration. And these aren't things that we can expect or should expect, you know, the high court to do. But him doing that, I do really think is commendable on lots of levels because he really went above and beyond to understand the issues. But to Timothy Lee's point, and to just say what Denise said, I mean, based on my listening to the, hearing, yeah, it did. It really did strike me as thinking, I don't know if you had the right guy for this. You had a really experienced lawyer, but I don't know if you had the right guy for this because this is, frankly, not just a very technical argument, but it's also like really tricky on like there. It's technical in multiple ways. It's technical from like the actual level, but it's also like there are a lot of technicalities about what you're trying to express.
And yeah, Lee really said someone, he should have used some colorful analogies.
Right. Yeah, right. Because yeah, I mean, I think it was Breyer who brought up, the QWERTY, example, which is a good one to bring up. And that, did kind of, but it's like your lawyer should be breaking this down and making the better analogies, the more colorful things, or at least being able to fight back when the justices are, trying to kind of come up with their own analogies to explain why that is different. And to me, and I could be wrong here, but I hear, the musical analogy and I'm thinking that's assuming there's only one way to write a song, which is untrue, but it's also confusing, the notes in music with like the product that comes from those notes.
Yeah. Justice Thomas clearly didn't understand it. He compared Google's actions to a football team taking a rival's playbook.
Right.
Gorsuch said, and this is really odd, other companies have been able to come up with phones that work just fine without engaging in this kind of copying.
Right, because they had their own languages.
Yeah.
I
think that what they don't understand is how important APIs are to interoperability. That's the agreed upon companies interoperate.
Interoperability is to everything.
Everything.
Right.
Yeah. And this
including,
is the lesson.
Including
from.
To Oracle.
Right. Yeah, by the way, Oracle uses Amazon's S3 API so that they're S3 compatible.
But I mean, you could even argue, I saw this a lot of places, like that they're using, IBM SQL, to create their flagship program.
It was based on SQL. Yeah.
I mean, because really, I think this is fundamentally, and this wasn't really the question before the court, but really, I think what this whole case has been about has been about a licensing thing. It's been about the fact that Google didn't initially pay to be part of the licensing process and then didn't settle, which frankly, I think they should have. And
well, now they might. Now they might think, yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, hopefully, I mean, I don't know, my best case scenario here, just having heard it, and I agree with Denise, I mean, you can't judge based on just the questions they ask, but given like what could potentially be on the line here, I hope they punt and they just like, bump it down to, either affirming or rejecting the lower court's opinion, but don't make any decisions on like the actual questions. Because if the response were to instead basically say that, you can copyright APIs, I don't think that's a good thing. I don't think that's a good thing for the industry at all.
I actually think it could be really interesting against the backdrop of the antitrust discussion we just had that Congress may look at the outcome of this case and see this as a way that companies can tie up their goods and, I was going to use the word extort, but that's not really accurate, demand large license fees for things that otherwise might be freely available had the court just made a different legal call.
Phil, what do you think?
So I think there's a difference here between what I want the world to be like and how the law is written and how to like bend the, you know, how to like bend the current issues into the current law. It's very clear that like APIs ought to be interoperable. Things should not be forced to be different just for the sake of being different. That regardless of how this decision goes, it's like it, the realistic worst case scenario is that it just adds additional complexity because now you just need to have more translation layers between APIs and you'll have to make them different just for the sake of getting around this law, and all of that is going to get automated anyway. So it won't have a practical effect other than, you know, there'll be like an extra layer of things to introduce bugs and complexity and some, you know, and some expense. I think the important thing is that there's more interoperability rather than less, and that APIs are crucial to the world working. And I think like people learn that from this case, but that's not the role of the court, right? The court's not trying to say like, which way should the world go? They're theoretically saying, well, what does the law say? Right. How do we apply this law to the current thing? And they're like, I just don't know. And honestly, it's not that important to me. I think regardless of which way this decision goes, yeah, there'll be some additional money that'll pass hands between lawyers on one side and lawyers on the other side. And then the industry already knows what the answer is, which is more interoperability and not less. And yeah, we may be, if it goes the wrong way, then maybe there's, you know, maybe there's just a little bit of extra layers and some more bugs and some more expense of getting things to work together, which would be unfortunate. But I don't think it's going to reverse this trend towards more interconnectivity. And then what effect it has on things like, you know, copyrights for music and stuff like that is also like, I don't know. And I don't think it's going to affect, you know, more than just the lawyers. It'll just be yet another full employment act for the lawyers on all sides of this.
Very sensible response, actually, because everybody else says the sky is falling.
Right. So. And the other way, and the point I was trying to make by talking about what Congress might do with this and how it might view it, is it might encourage Congress to view this as, oh, well, here are large companies getting even more power. Maybe this gives us even more incentive to start addressing how we can revamp antitrust law. Even though we're talking about copyright here, the market effect is similar.
Yeah. Well, I hope you're right.
But in other words, Congress would be the next level of review.
That's an important point, though.
Like what the court has done, Congress can write new
law. Can change. Yeah. That's such an important point because I think people sometimes say, well, the Supreme Court's ruled, it's over, it's done. But no, of course not. That's just the Supreme Court's interpretation of standing law. You can change the law.
Yes.
And that's what Congress does.
Yes.
You know, copyright law wasn't written for software, let alone for APIs. And so, of course, it's going to be a weird broken fit. So, maybe it's a good time to rethink about how we want things to be.
Okay. I'm behind that one. I'm behind that one. Let's take a little time out. Do we have a short video about the fun times we had? I like to look back. I'm nostalgic about this week earlier on Twit. God, I feel terrible. I've been keeping Steve Martin on hold. It's good to talk to you, Steve.
Good to talk to you. Was at a concert where I had arranged tickets for you to come see Martin Short and myself.
You're never gonna let this go, are you? That was like five years ago.
On Twit.
He felt so bad
about
it. Hands
on iOS.
Coming up on Hands on iOS, I am going to show you a fun new feature you can take advantage of in iOS 14. You can just simply double tap on the back of the phone, and voila, it took a screenshot.
Twit events.
What better way to celebrate Security Month by planning some attacks and defending?
I think the perimeter is dead at this point in time, and we all agree on that. Like
there's no perimeter.
Exactly.
It's wide open.
This was a unique opportunity for hackers to do damage.
All about Android.
This is the Google TV with Chromecast. I really prefer the sort of caveman way of using an IR remote. This is a great way that Google is going to compete directly with the Apple TVs and Rokus.
Tech News Weekly.
Google Home 2020, also known as Nest Audio.
It's covered in fabric like most of the other Google products released in the last couple of years. Could this be used with a, say, a Chromecast with Google TV as dedicated wireless speakers next to your television? The answer, unfortunately, is no.
Oh.
You can't use it like that. This is only a Chromecast.
Twit, I see you touching your face, Leo.
I was. How did you see that? He caught me. That was, by the way, a great event we had on Thursday, the Attack and Defense event. It's available at twit.tv/events. It's the number 9 event. Bruce Schneier, guru of security, Jerry Buchelt, who's the CISO at LogMeIn, Brian Chiebert from This Week in Enterprise Tech, and our favorite hacker, the digital Jesuit Father Robert Ballasair. He is, I've decided, a level 40 chaotic cleric because he caused some trouble. But that I think we all learned an awful lot from that hour-long special event. So thank you, LastPass, for sponsoring that and letting us put that together. That was a lot of fun for Cybersecurity Month. Our show today brought to you by Worldwide Technology, talking about cybersecurity. Worldwide Tech and Cisco, WWT, offers you security solutions and services to protect your business. My question for you, it's a question I ask Russell all the time, our IT guy. How prepared are you? Attackers are constantly updating their strategy. I learned so much on Thursday. Oh, my God, I'm terrified. But are you prepared? WWT can help you prepare to combat next-gen threats. Your team provides resources and the platforms to make it possible. They've been doing it for over 2 decades. They've got the track record. We were so impressed. Lisa and I flew out to St. Louis to visit WWT back in March. It was our last trip before quarantine. And I was just blown away by WWT's commitment to systems, to how things work, to understanding. They built that amazing advanced technology center, $500 million worth of enterprise gear, so they can test, they can roll out proofs of concept for their customers. They're amazing. WWT worked with a large healthcare organization to conduct a security risk assessment of their certified electronic health record technology. It's something a lot of health organizations are trying to do, but you got to be really, really careful. WWT's consultants use their expert knowledge, state-of-the-art tools, in-depth analysis, skilled training, and repetition to complete their assessment. You'll actually be glad to know that 90% of the vulnerabilities they found at this healthcare organization could easily be fixed by putting in a comprehensive, systematic approach for patching. It was that simple. But that's the kind of thing you need to know. And I think a lot of companies just hide their head in the sand and say, I'm sure we're doing the right thing. You need to go to WWT. They worked with a big retail bank to help them achieve their primary goal of establishing an infrastructure that could prevent, and if they couldn't prevent, survive a catastrophic cybersecurity event. WWT helped them reduce system outages by 40%. And by the way, saved them money. Ongoing cost savings of 48% through infrastructure automation. Whether it's endpoint security, network security, identity and access management, or creating the latest zero trust architecture, which is what we talked a lot about on Thursday, the idea that there is no perimeter. Assume that everybody could be malicious. You could build a next generation security architecture based on strong identity management, encryption, and segmentation. This is what you need to thwart the most advanced attacks. No matter what business you're in, security has to be job one. See how WWT can protect your business assets and intellectual property with a holistic security approach. And, of course, they partner with Cisco to give you the best tools to get it done. Go to WWT.com/twit to get started. Let Worldwide Technology help you. WWT.com/twit. WWT, delivering digital outcomes and modernizing IT infrastructure all over the world. They're really a great group of people. I'm really proud to be partnered with them now. This is a good year for us, the two of us together. They were much needed all over the enterprise. Let's see. John McAfee in jail. Oh, my God.
Things happen to a nicer guy.
Yeah, what a story. The DOJ indicted him for tax evasion.
of all things. That's what they got Al Capone for, too. Who owns it, McAfee? Is it IBM now? The company that owns McAfee antivirus was quick to say, we have nothing to do. Nothing to do with him. 55, the SEC filing with 55 pages. Apparently, McAfee was promoting fraudulent ICOs. Those are internet coin offerings. It's like an IPO, but with a C instead of a P. Initial coin offerings using basically cryptocurrency to fund offerings.
He received. In his defense, it's not clear what a non-fraudulent ICO is.
This is true.
It like deal
100% accurate, though.
Excellent point. Those aren't around anymore. People have learned their lesson, I would hope. This was in 2017 and 2018. He promoted 7 different ICOs and apparently received $11.5 million worth of promoted tokens as a result. So
hope he cashed out, man, you know?
Yeah, you know, when you get that Bitcoin, don't put it in a wallet and forget the password. I'm just saying.
Yeah. Yes, this is true. You've been through that.
I'm just saying. Yeah, turn it into greenbacks as quickly as you can.
Well, I had to sell mine because of potential conflict of interest, and then I never even wrote about it again. And
what?
And
Microsoft so didn't I, want you to own
this
any.
This is not Microsoft.
This
was not Microsoft. This was Mashable. So this is going way, way back. So I wrote something in like 2012 about like an explainer Bitcoin.
This means you sold it at nothing for nothing.
Well, no, I sold it for a little more than that, but I bought in at like $10 a coin.
How much did you have?
I had 15 coins. So
you'd be a millionaire today.
I mean, I'd be much better off. I had to sell for like, I don't know, like $200 a coin or something. So I did well, but it was not like what it would have been at all.
What's 15 times $11,375?
It's over $1 million.
It's a lot.
Or it's over $100,000.
Yeah. It's good money.
So it's not over a million. Sorry.
At one point it was 20,000, so it could have been 600,000. Or no. Yeah, 600,000. At one point.
I wouldn't be in a closet, as someone in IRC pointed out. That is correct.
It would be a much nicer closet.
It would be a much nicer closet. It would be like the closet of my dreams. It would be like Paris Hilton's closet. Yeah.
Dana Carvey once said, the only thing about getting rich is you have a nicer bedroom to watch TV in. So it's like that. You'd have a nicer closet to do your podcast.
I do have to say, though, like that at least, like, I think that you, like, locking yours in your wallet
so
is like the worst.
I have
like,
7, like, still own them, can't get to them.
And there's no way. Like,
I gave them to Florence Ion. That's right. I don't even own them anymore, Florence. I gave them said, here's the wallet. Do what you will.
Do what you will. Hack into it.
I'm hoping.
Maybe quantum computers will be able to help us get you into your Bitcoin wallet one day.
That might solve it. Nobel Prizes for the gene editing pioneers who created CRISPR. 2 women, Emmanuelle Charpentier and Jennifer Doudna. By the way, this was a good year for women in the Nobel Prizes. I think the first Nobel Prize to physics to go to a woman went to... Right? Am I right? Was that the first time a physics prize has gone to a woman? Roger Penrose and I can't remember his collaborator's name. Nobel Prize for their work on black holes. Okay, nothing to say about that. So moving on. Speaking of digital currency, I was surprised to see this. Apparently the Federal Reserve has joined with 7 other central banks to talk about how, if you were going to do a federal digital currency, how should it be designed? The U.S. Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, the Bank of England, and the Bank for International Settlements. 26-page report, the foundational principles and core features of central bank digital currencies. They want to get in on the act. They're not saying they're doing it. But they're saying if we were going to do it,
like Facebook buying Instagram.
Yeah, this is a good time. Get in on it. I have some Bitcoin I could give you.
Right.
So there are 4
tenets of a central bank currency. They don't want, for instance, a central bank to compromise financial stability by issuing coins. It would need to coexist with existing forms of money. Core features, convertible to maintain singleness of the currency. A CBDC should be exchanged at par with cash and private money. It should be as easy to use as cash. You shouldn't have a wallet with a password you can't remember. You're tapping a card or scanning a mobile phone. It should be accepted and available. It should be usable in many of the same types of transactions as cash. And then I just got a pop-up ad from Firefox blocking the fourth one. It's not that important. Not that important. I don't know why Firefox started doing that all of a sudden.
Would they use a blockchain? Like, that's the interesting thing to me. Like, because you could do a digital currency without having to, you know, use a blockchain. So
I'm guessing not, because these are central banks. And the whole point of a central bank is to centralize all the information in one entity. And the whole point of blockchain is to decentralize.
I don't know. So I guess. But it becomes an interesting thing, which is like, okay, you wanted to have all these, you know, tenets of cash, except presumably anonymity, right?
Real anonymity.
Presumably that's not something they actually want to preserve with this, because I can't see that being one of their tenets, right? Like, I assume that they want it traceable.
I don't see anything about blockchain in here. That's a good point. It's interesting that they're at least looking at it. Sweden, Switzerland, the European Central Bank, the Bank of England, Bank of Japan, and Bank of Canada. Just thought I'd pass that along. Slack, this is good. This will really help productivity. We might have to switch to Teams. Slack is introducing Instagram-like stories and push-to-talk audio, so that's great. Slack is supposed to be for work. We use Slack, but maybe we should. Teams doesn't have stories, does it?
No, I mean, I hope not. I hope that's not a feature that we copy. The way that they've positioned it actually is less bad than the headline. The headline, I mean, is just, it seems like it'd be just a terrible and awful idea. The way they positioned it is to say that it would be like replacing, kind of like Loom, which is a startup that kind of lets you create asynchronous videos so you could replace your daily stand-up with, you know, short videos that people record rather than having to have everybody meet it at one time. That could be useful. My concern is that by them saying stories, that indicates to me that the interaction model would be like the, you know, Snapchat, Instagram stories motif, where you see someone's icon and you have to tap or click on it and then watch the update. And if that's the case, then that to me, like, completely ruins the productivity aspect. If it were instead just like everybody can upload, you know, like a very short video clip to this channel or this conversation or whatever, then maybe that's interesting. That's, again, very similar to Loom.
There's some use for that. Yeah, there's some use for that.
Right, I was very much enjoying some of the Twitter conversations where people were like, can we fix some of these other things?
Yeah, you know? Just try to stay up for, although I shouldn't say that to you, because Microsoft's had a little trouble this week.
Oh, I mean, obviously,
keeping the servers.
Look, glass houses, Leo. I'm not making any of those claims. I as a Slack user, and I enjoy Slack, but I'm like, that is not something I care about. It's about being like wanting to have to like click on people's photos to see their updates. Like, that's just, I don't want that as my user experience.
On Tuesday, when the president was hopped up on steroids and tweeted a bunch of all caps tweets, among others, he tweeted this: repeal Section 230. That's it. That is all. 3 exclamation marks. I'm amazed he even knows what Section 230 is.
Well, he did that executive order.
Oh, that's right. That's right. So he does know what it is. Yeah.
Yeah, he knows what it is, but he doesn't know how to. He doesn't seem to know that he doesn't have the power to repeal it by an executive order.
Congress has introduced 17 different bills attacking Section 230 this year. The White House has 2 executive orders or 2 proposals. This was after his Facebook and Twitter posts saying that the flu is more deadly than COVID-19. Spoiler, it's not. So now maybe he doesn't like me either, because Twitter put a misinformation warning on it, and Facebook surprisingly, because they've been pretty tolerant, they removed the post entirely. But ironically, neither Biden nor Trump seem to understand what Section 330 does. Both of them seem to not like it. As Mike Masnick points out in Tech Dirt, it would create the exact opposite of what he thinks would happen. Rather than putting pressure on social media companies to leave his posts alone, it'll make them more likely to put it down because their safe harbor
would go away.
Would go away, and they could be sued. Right now, and it would be a problem for me. We have a chat room, and we have a forum, and I would immediately shut them down if 230 disappeared because I could be sued over any of the content that's there. 230 provides protection for social media, for chatters, for everybody. Otherwise, who would run a chat room? The internet would barely exist without 230.
So. Right, and as Mike points out, they would have to, I mean, not only would it break the internet in so many ways, but specifically it would break the internet in that anything that someone tried to post would need to be vetted before it could get posted.
Imagine, Facebook, more than 2 billion monthly active users vetting every single thing you posted before it would appear.
That would actually, if you want to talk about splitting up, if you want to talk about ending big tech, that's how you end big tech, is enacting a law like that, because those sorts of businesses would not be able to continue. They just wouldn't.
I guess that addresses the conservative congresspeople's concerns about being discriminated against. You know, they just, nobody would be able to post their thoughts to the internet.
Do you think, Denise, there would be like this insane lawsuit avalanche if Section 230 were repealed or repealed? It can't repeal it. If the law were to be changed, let's put it that way.
No, I mean, I think Mike has hit the nail on the head that companies aren't going to let that happen. They're not going to expose themselves to that kind of liability. No. They're going to change the way they operate, and the internet will fundamentally change.
Would it be prudent for me to shut down our chat room and our forums and not allow comments anywhere on any of our sites? It would be prudent, right?
That's the examination that every company is going to have for every sort of instance where they allow the public to use their platform to post something. They're going to have to decide, do we still want to take on that liability? It would be as though, if we use a real world example, you know, a library or a grocery store would have to ask you or require you not to speak with the other patrons when you're there because you might defame them or some such thing in your interaction with them. And if the store or facility were going to be liable, they wouldn't let you do it.
Denise, would it become a First Amendment issue if it were that broad? If there was some, like, would that potentially, like, because usually these things aren't First Amendment, like, speech issues, you know, in terms of, like, what private, organizations will allow or won't allow. But if there was some sort of law passed with these sorts of things, would that potentially become a First Amendment issue?
It could, as to government sites. That's really where the First Amendment kicks in. Private entities like Facebook and Twitter, et cetera, they get to, they're not really impacted by the First Amendment. They get to
I should have been more clear, because I understand obviously that the private companies aren't bound by that. But since, you know, the message of speech is being transferred using, it's not quite a public utility, but it certainly has backing, you know, the internet itself of, you know, like publicly funded things. Does that change it at all?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question. Section 230 doesn't just apply to private entities. The language is internet service provider, I believe, something along those lines, and that not meaning ISP in the way that we understand that term.
Right.
But, you know, the platform on which you're interacting. And that could be a, you know, it could be Facebook providing a platform for a congressperson, say, to interact with their constituents, and then they can't because Facebook's shutting that down.
That's
where courts have said the First Amendment kicks in, and protects that kind of speech. That's, you can't block people, et cetera. The First Amendment could well come into play there.
It would be a mess.
Yeah.
Fortunately, Congress isn't doing nothing. But yeah. I want to point out both candidates in the election coming up in 3 weeks, both candidates have said they want to repeal or somehow change Section 230.
So, yeah, you're kind of out of luck if you're a one issue voter on that issue.
Yeah, so you might, this would be an opportune moment to write a letter or something.
Donate to the EFF.
Donate to the EFF. Write to your Congress critter. Let them know how you feel. Gosh, this has become the court and government episode, hasn't it? One more story. California judge has denied Epic's request that Apple be forced to reinstate Fortnite in the App Store. They did say that on the Unreal Engine cannot be, harmed, that Apple was threatening to revoke developer accounts to Epic Games. The judge said this was actually, this has already happened in a preliminary injunction, and now it's been reaffirmed that, Apple can kick you out of the store. No, they can't. Take away your developer certificates for the Unreal Engine. So I don't know. Is there more to say about that? This one we're going to hear a lot more. The trial is until May 3rd.
I guess the only thing I have to add there is that this is the kind of thing, it doesn't matter so much what this court does or doesn't do, except for how Congress is going to interpret what the courts are doing and whether Congress needs to step in, because Apple's control of its app store is a huge part. It's the primary part of what Congress is concerned about Apple,
right.
on the antitrust front.
Actually, if you read those 14 juiciest quotes, two of the juicier quotes are actually from Apple, showing that they do indeed sometimes favor companies, Baidu in this case, even though they denied that repeatedly and have often said no, we treat everyone fairly. I'm gonna call it. I think we've had enough court and legal action for the day. I am so glad my counselor was here from This Week in Law, Denise Howell. It's great to see you always. I'm glad things are going well, and I
so great to be here.
Come back soon. Anything you want to plug?
I don't want to plug anything in particular. I just want to emphasize how happy and lucky I feel to be here with you all today. I hope you're all doing well.
Yes.
I want to take a moment to congratulate you, Leo, on what is it? You started this network in 2005?
15 years ago. Yeah.
Oh my God. So,
I was a young man when this all started. No.
It's such a great community.
I wasn't even a young man then.
Yeah. It's such a great community and tribe that you've developed. And I'm just so thrilled. You have many podcast options, all of you listening to us, probably more than ever today. So the fact that you've joined us all today means the world to me, and I'm sure all of us.
Thank you.
And it's been a tough year, and it's not getting any easier. And I just want to tell people how much I appreciate them. And I'm good at answering emails. I'm Denise at twit.tv. If anything's on your mind, you just need to vent, talk, chat, connect, I'm here.
Isn't that nice of you?
Shout out.
You're just great. Thank you, Denise. Ditto right back to you. I've always thought the world of you, and I'm thrilled to be able to get you on the show. Same with you, Christina. Christina Warren, she's Film Girl. I've known you since you were knee high to a grasshopper.
You have.
Yeah.
You have. Yeah. I'm always so grateful and happy every time you ask me to be on the show. And I've been a fan of yours since I was younger, let's just say. Exactly. Can I plug something real quick?
Please, yes.
Okay, so this is kind of cool. I've got a new podcast coming out. I believe it'll be on Wednesday, that I did with Verizon and T-Brand at the New York Times, and it's called Networked and the 5G Future. I know we were kind of making fun of 5G.
Oh, God, I hope I didn't get you in trouble.
No, you're fine. But it's actually really interesting. I interviewed a ton of people in different industries, education, healthcare, sports, esports, music, in cities and whatnot. And we talked about what some of the challenges around connectivity are, and not talking about like solutions that might fix it in like the near term, but solutions that technology could empower to maybe solve some of those or, you know, help with some of those challenges in the future. The first episode's about education. It'll be out this Wednesday. I'm really happy with how it turned out. And so networked, just want to plug that.
That's great. Where can we find it? I guess wherever podcasts.
Just wherever you want to get podcasts. And just, if you just search networked on you know, Apple Podcasts or Google or Spotify or whatever. I think there's like a 2-minute kind of, you know, preview thing right now. And then the first episode will be out this week.
Networked, the 5G future, hosted by Christina Warren. I'm so thrilled. That's exciting. Is it an open-ended one, or are there going to just be a number, just a certain number of shows?
Well, we recorded a certain number of episodes, but I don't know, like, for sure. Like, I mean, there's always a possibility it could go beyond that. But okay. but we recorded a certain number of episodes, and that was kind of my fun quarantine project. So
fun.
It was.
Well, yeah. I'm ready to hear a case be made for 5G. So good. I want to hear all about it. That's great. Great. Thank you so much. And Phil Thanks Libin, another me. Person I've known for a long time and I've always been proud. Now he's in his honey. You're back in your beehive. You're muted also. There's no buzzing in the beehive.
I'm not being muted.
now you're okay. Now you're okay.
No, I wasn't before. Can you actually hear me?
Yeah. I couldn't hear you earlier. Yeah.
Weird.
All of these great backgrounds come from Phil's app. Mm-hmm. MMHMM.app. Is it free? You've never asked for money.
Well, we're still in beta, so it's still
that's
beta,
why
you can sign up at that app, and then when we launch, which hopefully is coming up pretty soon now, I think we're getting close, it'll be freemium. It'll be a free version, it'll be a premium version. You know, we are big believers in direct revenue models only. So
nice.
You know, yeah. We make money when people want to pay us for using our products.
You've learned, and I see you've added a lot of features. This is great.
Yeah, there's a bunch of new stuff.
Yeah.
New stuff coming out just about every week. I got to plug, I love whatever it takes. Denise's idea of a world where people are not allowed to speak to me at a grocery store.
Just stay out of my aisle, man. I don't care. I don't even want you in the aisle with me. I want to be all alone, and I want my aisle to myself.
Whatever it takes.
It's the weirdest thing. Sometimes you go shopping, and you're all alone in an aisle, and suddenly five people come, and they come nearer and nearer and nearer. Dun-dun, 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 dun-dun. And I'm like, and I'm masked up. I got a face shield. I'm going to have to get more scary stuff to protect me. Okay, no one can ask Phil anything in the grocery store, okay? If you see him, just wave, say, I know who you are. I appreciate your work. All-turtles.com. It's always great to have you on. You're so smart, and you've got so much history and so much knowledge about the industry.
Thank you. It's always good to be on here.
Our show, This Week in Tech, appears every Sunday. We do the show. We record it, and you're welcome to watch us do it live. Sunday afternoon, 2:30 Pacific, 5:30 Eastern, 21:30 UTC. The live streams, there's audio and video, and there are a variety of each at twit.tv/live. So, and by the way, if you're watching live, you certainly should be in the chat room because they're all chatting at the same time, and it's irc.twit.tv. And the live stream sometimes has recorded material after the fact, after the show's over, like later tonight, but the chat room seems to go on all the time. They're talking at me. They're pretending that I'm listening. I'll sometimes sneak in there and go, I hear what you're saying, just to throw them off. It's a great place, irc.twit.tv. Most people, though, listen or watch on demand. We have on-demand audio and video available in a variety of places. Our website's the first place to look, twit.tv. Actually, all of our shows are there. We also have a YouTube channel for this and every other show we do. Just go to youtube.com/twit. You'll find links to all the individual channels plus Twit Bits and other features there. Or search for Twit in your favorite podcast application and subscribe. And that way you'll kind of get it automatically. We are putting together our best ofs. In fact, I think, you know, we're getting, believe it or not, getting close to finishing them. I know it's only October. But we run these at the end of the year, kind of our holiday specials. If you have a moment from this show or any of our Twitch shows that you say, oh, that it has to be from this year, but I know this has been an interesting year. It has to be in the best of at the end of the year. Go to twit.tv/best of, and you can fill out a form there. You don't have to fill out every field, but anything you can give us will help us
figure out where that clip was from and perhaps include it in our Best Of episode, which will be coming up later this year. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. We'll see you next time. As I have said now for 15 years in a row, another twit
this is amazing.
In the can. Bye-bye.